Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today we have Yash Hemmaraj. Yash is the general partner with BGV. Yash, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Christian.
So why don't we start with BGV? Would love to know the firm's investment thesis.
So BGV, we are an early stage enterprise software firm. We are based out of Menlo Park and have offices in Israel, France, and India. We invest in early stage enterprise companies, primarily pre-Series A to Series A stages. A lot of our companies are born in innovation hubs such as Israel, France, and India. And we help those companies come over to the US and help them scale up over here. About $500 million assets under management and with 50 plus companies invested over the last decade.
So let's start talking about any verticals or industries that you focus on, and if not, anything that you're bullish on in particular at the moment.
Yeah, so one of the core investment theses is around the future of human-centric enterprise AI. There have been dozens of billions of dollars invested every year over the last several years on companies that are building up to the infrastructure. And this has provided us a layer of democratized AI. But we see the next level of productivity gains being brought into enterprises. And the right use of AI in these enterprises are those that augment human capacity. Machines have become really, really good at process execution, generating insights from vast amounts of data. But we believe in the human strategy and the presence of humans in that guardrails, in having that ethical guardrails and governance around AI. So in the ideal spirit, we see employees as orchestrators of workflows in enterprises. And this will drive the next generation of productivity improvements. Typically, this kind of falls into two buckets. One is, founders with deep domain expertise in certain verticals, completely reimagining those business processes and building vertical agents targeted to these vertical industries. On the other hand, every enterprise function, be it sales, marketing, FinOps, customer ops, being completely automated by using AI, but with the human in the loop. So these type of function-specific agents. So those are the two broad buckets that we have been investing in.
So, I'd be curious. So one of the, conversation that comes up are hallucinations. And my response is, I would anticipate in time that we see an improvement, but that it will never necessarily eliminate the need for a human in the loop because... Mm-hmm. It can be difficult to discern intent. And so you need someone to QA results. I'd love to know your opinion. How do you see this evolving?
Yeah. So when you think about an enterprise context, right? The way we think about an enterprise AI system is it's not just working with AI components, especially in more traditional industries. You go in and you lead with AI, you completely lose the plot. Because in the best forms of AI, in our opinion, are those that are actually invisible. Don't get me wrong, better AI means better insights, better AI means faster convergence of the models, better AI models means more accurate decisions. But when you look at a factory floor worker, they don't really care about how AI is being used. They care about doing their 8-to-5 job well and going home to their family. And that is the main spirit of how we think about enterprise systems. It is around full stack systems that brings multimodal AI along with workflows and data. And And the best part about putting these three things in a full stack vertical systems is that you can build in control loops so that when an error is detected, you know how to correct for it. And a lot of the, I mean, if you think about systems engineering, right, you know, there is always guardrails in every aspect of the system. So how do you build these guardrails into every aspect? I'll take an example, right? You know, you have Waymo operating completely autonomous service in the city of San Francisco. About 10 years ago, if you were to ask the same question, saying that, you know, there will be autonomous vehicles which will deliver higher quality of service to customers, people would be skeptical. And there would be questions around, hey, look, wait until it gets stuck in the middle of a busy intersection, or wait until, you know, it doesn't know how to park itself. 100 different kind of skepticism, rightfully so, would arise, right, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But the pace of innovation has been that when you hit a problem, you have additional tools and you bring in the right mechanisms to solve it. So in the context of the hallucination question that you asked, I think that is what you will see in enterprises today. When you think about these enterprise, be it vertical agents or a function-specific agents, initially there will be hallucinations, but if you design it from a systems perspective, you will have the control loops in there to kind of, you know, prevent them, identify them, prevent them, and work on mechanisms to fix it. So those are so when we think about our entrepreneurs, we expect them to have these type of guardrails right from the beginning, not as an afterthought. So that's kind of where we have spent a lot of time building advisory groups, building frameworks to help our founders.
Well, you started to answer my next question, and that was when you start to look at potential investments and conduct due diligence, what are the criteria that you look at? And I was going to ask, you know, what was the degree that founders are demonstrating that they're thinking about solving these problems? But let me stop there and ask. Please, I would love to know, what's the criteria that BGV uses when evaluating potential investments?
We have like a very broad kind of set of criteria that we have defined, which is kind of about 7 by 3 matrix, so about 21 different parameters that we look at when we evaluate a company. We call it our Screen Zero framework to kind of identify not just metrics which are quantitative, but also have a lot of qualitative metrics associated with it, attributes that are associated with this. And so typically they fall under very broadly, you know, the same buckets around, you know, the market that the entrepreneurs are going after, the team, technology, traction, competitive dynamics, and, you know, what is the business model associated with all of them, right? But underlying it, you know, we have a lot of lessons around what the right teams look like, especially when you're going after some traditional industries, right? So the next generation of companies are AI native companies. They won't look like SaaS companies, so they will need a slightly different mindset. So what do the pricing model look like? And having the founders have lived through the journey of, you know, these vertical markets, right? If you want to sell something into the utility industry, you need to have very detailed understanding of how decisions work, how buyer committees work, what are the pricing models that are feasible in these industries. So the founders need to have those really fine-grained detail, right? But they also need to have a complementary set of skill set within the founding team. So if a founder is deeply technical, we like to kind of, you know, see founders with who that they can bring on additional folks who have this business mindset. And kind of, you know, they bring them also. I mean, it's very interesting that some founders have the ability to kind of really embrace folks that are complementary and bring them on. Because at the early days, right, you know, you need to sell your vision and you need to convince the best of the best to come and join you based on that mission. Because guess what? You cannot offer the salaries that a Google or an OpenAI is paying for these companies. You need to kind of, bring them in with the vision and the mission, right? So those are the founders that we try to gravitate towards. But along with that, you need to have the deep technology understanding on how your company gets better and better over time. What systems are you going to install in order to do that? The details around what's the pricing model that you're going to do? The best founders kind of, have, when it comes to pricing, go to market, et cetera, have the right spirit of quick experimentation and quick learning, right? So this is the qualitative aspects of what we spend, and that's where we spend a lot of time with our founders, and understand whether they have a set vision or whether they have this growth mindset around doing quick experiments, learning from it, and bringing them into the company culture. So those are the things that we evaluate.
I'd be curious to know whether or not you see a trend around singular founders or co-founders.
So we always gravitate towards having co-founders in the company, because building a startup, and all of us have been on the operating side in our firm, we all know how lonely it can be if you're just by yourself. It takes a village to build an enterprise B2B company, and we like to kind of see that the founder has people to lean on, and obviously our goal is to partner well, very tightly, roll up our sleeves, and work with those founders. But we also want to not just work with one person, but the team associated with the company. So that's where we always gravitate towards having co-founders.
Interesting. So, if we could stop there for a moment, I'd love to know what your experience was leading up to joining BGB.
So I was born and raised in India, did my education and engineering, electrical engineering over back in India, and came here as soon as I finished my undergrad to do my master's at University of Maryland. And that's where I got involved in wireless communication, and started working in a company that was building 4G technologies back in 2006. And that led to getting to know a team, which eventually brought me to Silicon Valley, where the team was kind of starting a new company in the again in the wireless industry. We took an entire city's radio infrastructure and miniaturized it to fit the size of a building. Think about a million square foot type of building, like a huge mall or a casino or maybe a cruise ship, right? So these type of square footage, we put an entire radio network in those type of facilities. I was one of the first few engineers there. Worked there for about 6 to 7 years, and then I realized that I love working with startups, but wireless industry was an industry where there are only four customers in every geo, right? Be it US, Canada, you look at it, there are only four to five major players. It means that most of the buyer power is with them, and they have very little incentive to kind of continue the innovation map. And I loved working with early stage. I loved working with founders. So I decided to go get my MBA, and on the other side of MBA, wanted to switch to venture capital. That's when I joined BGV back in 2014, and I've been with the same firm since then. About the last 11 years.
Fantastic. And I have to give a shout out to University of Maryland. Our oldest daughter is also a Terrapin.
Go
Great,
Terps.
great, great school. So sounds like an amazing experience. And now you've spent 11 years at BGV. So would love to know to the degree. So once you've made an assessment, you made a decision that a portfolio company or a company is well aligned to be a part of the portfolio. What's the degree of support that you get involved, and if you can, and you can include there, your time as an operator and how that influences, the degree that you see yourself getting involved.
I was very early on. I was in a panel in with the founder, and somebody asked him this question, and he kind of very crisply illustrated the role of a good venture investor, right? And I have kind of taken it to heart and kind of built my practice around it, is around a founder, especially in those early days. I'm not talking about companies when they have 20, 200, 300 people, but these are when they have just a few people. The role of the founders is to do 10, 15 things all in parallel. They need to go on a sales call, they need to do marketing by themselves sometimes, they need to go attend that industry event, recruit people, do all the corporate governance thing. They have never been on board sometimes. They need to understand how to raise next round of financing. 10 to 15 different things, right? And if you can make each of those 10 things 10% easier, right? 10 things 10% easier, the compounding effect is that you're given a 2.5x advantage to those founders. So this really crystallizes kind of the way I approach venture capital, and at the firm we approach venture capital, is to kind of really roll up our sleeves and partner with the founder, saying, okay, what do you have to do next? Here are some things that you need to be pay attention in. How do you prepare for it? And make each one of those things 10% easier. So along those lines, what we have done is are a few things. One, all of us in the partnership are our operators. So we bring our network as operators of other operators into the firm. So we have created a sales and marketing advisory network, which focuses on all the aspects of go-to-market, right? Sales, marketing, customer success, et cetera. We have a technology advisory circle that focuses on various aspects of technology. And we have a human AI advisory group that focuses on this human-centric AI aspect that I described earlier, right? So this group helps us, gives us a lot of advantage on top of just the operating team, to
Sure.
kind of, give ideas on how to make each of those companies better, identify interesting, maybe corporate connections, maybe interesting people who can join the firm, et cetera. So that's one very specific thing that we have built around, involving a broader group. The second thing that we have done is we have taken all of our learnings as operators, my partner Eric Benham has taken 10 companies public. I come from products. My partner Anik has done corporate venturing, has done corp dev. Eric Butua has been a general manager at various technology companies and has a couple of decades of venture experience. So all of us bring various aspects of the of building companies, right? So what we try to do is we have built playbooks in each one of them, right? How do you do, for example, if you're getting ready for an exit, what is a typical M&A process looks like? How do you do fundraising? How do you kind of put install a proper corporate governance? How do you kind of handle board conversations? So these are all various, very specific playbooks that we have created that are available for our founders to kind of incorporate in their daily operating system of the company. And the last thing that we have done is very we have built around 120 corporate relationships that various different industries, leading from manufacturing to utilities to high-tech companies. And we have those relationships that we are constantly building and expanding. And this gives a lot of innovation opportunities for our founders. So all of these things contribute to giving that 10 things 10% easier capabilities to the founders.
I love it. That's brilliant. So one of the things that if we could start with is on the financing front. A lot of different perspectives in the ecosystem and the best way to approach it. But I'm all ears. Would love to know what advice would you give founders who are looking to raise capital for the first time?
If they're raising capital for the first time, what I would say is go create a network of 10 to 15 people that you have worked with. Right, I'm talking about that first round of financing, right? Pre-seed round of financing, and kind of talk to them and bring them on as some sort of an advisor or even a co-founder or an angel investor. What this gives you is that each one of them brings to you either an insight or a network that they can contribute. So suddenly you have surrounded yourselves with a group of people who are rooting for you and who can also contribute some capital. So that's my first advice for if you're starting off, just go and talk to hundreds of people within your network, right? And that will give you a lot of insights. There will be a lot of people who will say you shouldn't do it, but I would say also don't heed to the advice all the time, because sometimes a lot of these ideas are things that nobody else thought about, but you have a unique insight, but you listen to them. So and you take that feedback, process it, and kind of start off from there, right? But then if you've worked with the right set of people, they will make introductions to a broader group of investors, including seed funds, pre-Series A funds, Series A funds. So that will give you open up the opportunity to kind of raise institutional capital. Now, on the capital side, really think about what I refer to as you must be familiar with minimum viable product, right? So this is the first kind of definition of what the founders will build so that they can take it to their prospective customers. Even before you build the whole thing, you put together and then something that kind of gives a representation of what you're going to build. So I have an analogy on the capital side, what's called the minimum viable capital, which is basically if you break down what you're going to do into milestones and say, okay, look, here is where I am today, and here's where I want to be. If I'm here, I have this type of validation from the market, because in the early stage, that's what you find. Not always you find revenues. Revenue is the wrong proxy to look for, where the right proxy is to kind of look for validations, right? So if I do X, Y, and Z, here is kind of the validation that I get from the market. And you start kind of building towards what is that minimum amount that you need in order to get those validations? Be it, hey, I need to kind of develop this prototype into a functional XYZ product. I need two people to do that. And I need maybe somebody who understands this problem to kind of really solve that, basically customer success for those initial set of customers, right? So put those things together and kind of create, okay, give myself another 18 to 24 months, and what's the capital that I need without counting any revenues coming from customers. So go raise that level of capital so that you are comfortable, your team is comfortable, and you're now working on kind of getting to those milestones. So that's the approach that I recommend that founders follow in those really early stages.
I realize it can be situation dependent, but if a round is oversubscribed, what's your opinion? Do you find you generally tell the founder to be happy? But though it may end up with a higher valuation, or do you tell them to stick with the original amount of financing that they were seeking?
Typically, if my observation is that founders always underestimate the capital that they need. So if there is a little bit extra capital, but you find the right investors who are there alongside your journey, bring them on, because it does take a village to build an enterprise B2B company. Even though, I mean, the So the interesting thing that you see in with the advancement of AI, right, you can with 20, 30 people, you can build multi-million dollar revenue businesses today, because you can deploy AI in various aspects of what they're doing. But also you see the same companies also raising additional lot more capital. And the reason is that the spend has just shifted. When you're building these companies, so you may need to invest ahead in technology. You may need to invest in infrastructure, or at least renting out the infrastructure that is needed to kind of fine-tune your models, build small domain-specific models for your industry. So these all take time and capital. So I always recommend if you have access to capital, don't worry about the incremental dilution at this stage, because you can work on making the pie bigger, and that's where you have more capital and more people around you to help you make that pie bigger. So that's my suggestion usually.
Great. And so with that, obviously, as you point out, the firm is focused on the role of AI and human workflows. Are there any industries or verticals in particular that you're evaluating right now that you're really excited about?
One of our recent investments, and it's also kind of helped us kind of refine our thesis as well, is a company called WorkHelix. What they have done actually is they've studied 250,000 various aspects of work, job functions, right? And they've broken down into tasks and each task into subtasks. For example, even within a venture capital industry, when you think about what we have to do, we have to talk to founders, we have to kind of listen to what they're working on it, we have to do competitive surveys, we have to document them in investment memos, we have to go talk to our LPs, we have to give them frequent updates. All of this are individual tasks, but if you break down each one of them, there are subtasks, right? So they have kind of studied each of those tasks and assigned the automation score associated with that, so that you can effectively say, even if you're some of the you're a physical industry, right? Let's say John Deere, you can go in and say, here are five different areas where you can actually deploy AI today and start leveraging the benefits of AI, right? Even though you're selling equipment to like a farming business, right? Very, very physically oriented business. You can find places where today's AI can help you, right? So we have kind of leveraged the same framework and also built a framework to help us evaluate various different companies, and we evaluate them across like two vectors. On one side, we look at task complexity, and on the other side, we look at the need of human judgment, like things that require high human judgment and things that require low human judgment. And we have companies that, when you look at this 2x2 matrix, on one side, task complexity, and the other one, human judgment, in these four quadrants, we find opportunities for AI to disrupt in each one of them. For example, think about one of our companies called Everest Labs that uses computer vision and robotics to help material recycling facilities pick and sort trash, like things like the aluminum cans that you toss into your recycling bin, the glass bottles, the coffee cups. They all need to be segregated. So these are require low human judgment and low task complexity, and you can fully autonomously automate it using computer vision and robotics. On the other hand, think about like a medical treatment planning or venture capital or legal strategy, right? Those are the things where the tasks are quite complex and you require high human judgment. Even there, AI can be deployed, but the way you deploy it is by bringing them for strategic support. So in this way, in each place, we have very different things that we look for. We have built a portfolio across all of those four quadrants, but we look for different things in each one of them. So that's how our investing in AI thesis has kind of evolved.
And so I'm curious, how much weight then do you put on a path towards profitability, or if you feel like the problem set is large enough, will you be okay if they continue to operate at a loss?
Venture capital usually operates companies under losses, right? Because you're reinvesting everything into future, and that future either is coming in as people investments or technological investments or scaling up your go-to-market, right? So usually it's one of these three areas that you're. So we want founders who are a very specific about unit economics of a particular unit of sale, right? You know, if you're selling to an enterprise, you know, you're charging them 150,000, what is the cost of providing that service? So that means that what you need to deliver 10x value from what you charge, and you need to be able to show that ROI to your customers, right? So that's where we focus a lot of our diligence around. And then we see, okay, how many such kind of sale you can do, what's the total market size, you know, build it up bottoms up, right? But if that justifies, we are okay operating the company under the laws, so that, but you have to be, eventually you have to kind of have a roadmap towards profitability, because you cannot be perennially non-profitable, because as you get to closer to profitability, you find different class of investors who can come in and take the company from that stage to the next stage, right? But it is okay in those early days to kind of operate the company, because on the contrary, if you're kind of completely focused on bootstrapping yourself perennially, you miss the market, because you miss making those investments, and somebody else will come and accelerate and, you know, build that, you know, 10x advantage. You know, let's say you're investing only a little in technological advancement, but the opportunity is there. Somebody else is going to come and capitalize it. Let's now say you have the technological advancement. Now, if you don't build the go-to-market team around you to kind of sell each of those things, but they're all profitable units of sale, then somebody else will come and, you know, solve the distribution problem, right? So you've got to solve both the technology and the distribution problem to be a credible enterprise company. And that's where you have to invest ahead of time.
You know, I love it, and I 100% agree. I mean, focus on metrics is extremely valuable, whether it's, you know, gross margin, customer acquisition costs, you know, return on customer lifetime value, or customer acquisition costs. 100% agreed, and you know, I think it makes a really strong case for founders to make sure that they know their business intimately, so that they can use that to inform decision making. Yes, it's been a great podcast, a ton of great insights in here. One of the questions I love to ask before we wrap up is, if you had an opportunity to go back and have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share with?
That's a pretty tough one. I would say my initial perspective getting into venture capital is kind of, you know, was that, you know, you go and, you know, the time horizon for change to happen, I was expecting when I went in to be much smaller scale. But the realization is that, you know, this is a long-term industry, I would, if I were to go back and talk to my 10-year-old self, I'd say, you know, invest more heavily into building those longer-term relationships, you know, spending more time in building quality relationships with a wide variety of folks. Because at the end of the day, my realization is that, you know, this is a long time constant industry which is built heavily on relationships, and you got to kind of invest in those areas. One, if you do the right thing, those two aspects with that mindset, you're always kind of you'll find interesting opportunities. Founders will come, they will want to work with you, and you know, we'll solve those kind of, you know, individual company things, company issues, company challenges collectively. But if you got to start with the right group of people, with the right relationship, who are there for the longer term. So that's where I would go back and encourage myself to invest even more heavily than I've done.
I think that's great insight. You know, relationships seem to be underestimated. And I know myself included, I could spend a lot more time nurturing, you know, getting to know the people in my network, and, you know, understanding what's important to them. Yes, it's been a great podcast. If there are any members of our audience who'd like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
My wife jokes that I'm not on any other social network except LinkedIn, and I spend a lot more time on LinkedIn than I should. But I read all my LinkedIn messages. So if any of your listeners want to reach out to me, I think drop a direct message on LinkedIn, and I'll look at it, and I will kind of, if it's interesting or if I have something to contribute back, I will definitely get back to your listeners. Also, drop a note on kind of on this conversation so that I know where the reference came from as well. This has been great, Christian. Thank you, and again, you're doing a lot of giving forward to your community, and really appreciate what you have been doing, because I think by nurturing these conversations, I think a lot of the founders will benefit on kind of what they should be doing, how they should be thinking, etc., from the nature of the questions that you asked. I think it's a wealth of information that you're collecting and giving forward. So I really appreciate you doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. I thank you for the compliment. I appreciate it. There's so much to know, and as things turn out, we just don't know everything. And so if I can give back a little bit to the community and help speed up people's learning curves, my opinion is everybody wins. So but again, thank you in part to you. This is only possible because you contribute your time and your experience. So I very much appreciate that. And with that, again, for our audience, Ayesh Hemaranch, general partner at BGV. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. And this has been another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Thank you.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.